Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The countdown is counting down, and we are awaiting big tech earnings. The future of student loan debt may have a solution. And we're going to discuss that with our guest today, Chuck Trafton, CEO of Edly. All this and much more on episode number 685 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Today, how was your week? The good news, the really good news, is that the election is just days away, and if you're like many people that I know, well, you're going to be well relieved when it's finally over. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people, and they've been like, hey, you know what? What do you think about the election? Like, I don't know, but you know what? I'm just ready for this whole thing to be over. It seems like this is the longest election cycle ever. I don't know, maybe it's a similar feeling that we've had through other elections, but this one just seems to be going on and on and on. For a quick intro, I'm Andrew Horowitz. I am the host for this podcast, the place where we come together on the Disciplined Investor Podcast each and every week. And we discuss ways to help you essentially reach your financial independence. We help you become a more disciplined investor. And with that, what do we do? Well, we talk about all sorts of subjects. We talk about things ranging from just simple finance, and we try to get your brain uber saturated with information and education, right? That's what we try to do here. We're trying to get you as much information as possible about money and investing, economics, and, well, just general finance, I guess. So that's kind of what we are doing here on a regular basis, week in and week out. So with that, let's do a quick recap of the week, shall we? Generally, the markets were down this week. Notably, we had a few areas of the overall markets, not just stocks, but we saw crude oil down again. Now 3% for this week on concern that the coronavirus pandemic is going to sap demand. That's kind of what's going on right now. The thought that the shutdowns, lockdowns, curfews, and the increase in the pandemic numbers are going to cause a problem. Crude oil now down 42% for 2020. And this is kind of, I think, really interesting because we have been proponents of adding an exposure to commodities within portfolios for a really long period of time. And each time we looked at the portfolio allocation and we said, okay, we want a small position there to maybe guard against some inflation over the future. And what we wanted to do is really have some alternatives inside of a portfolio to be non-correlated, to have some kind of access to investments that are not necessarily just stocks, just bonds. And there's not a lot of ways to do that. You have to go outside the area of those and look at, well, real estate, and you want to look at some specialty bonds. You want to look at alternative asset managers, maybe commodities and things of that nature. Well, every time I looked at it over the last couple of years, I'm like, well, you know, they were doing okay, but not great. And they're giving us diversification, but we'd be better off maybe somewhere else. And it's not really dragging us because we don't have a big position, but it's not really helping us either. And we've kind of kept this whole notion, looking back historically on every time that I've done this over time, that, you know, usually commodities snap back pretty well right when you least expect it. And we start to rethink this because we're going to look to reposition the segment that is allocated towards commodities a little bit differently. Because a lot of times when you have a commodity exposure, whether it's through a pooled investment like a mutual fund or an ETF, it oftentimes will be an index base. And those indices that you look at when it comes to commodities are oftentimes pretty heavily invested in energy. And when we talk about energy, we talk about things like, well, simply crude oil, natural gas, right? These areas have not been doing well at all. And with that, the question then comes up, well, is it going to be once again those times when you look at this and you say, I'd be better off staying with it because we do know that it has a really good diversification profile, a non-correlation oftentimes to other investments that you have, the core investments, or is something changed? I mean, the real question right now we're focusing in on is about energy. It's not about the grains. It's not about the foods. It's not about necessarily the metals, whether it's precious or industrial. It's about energy. And what does the future really hold for crude and natural gas? Especially here we are in a time that looks like we are moving more and more towards EVs, electric vehicles, right? And with that, then what is going to be the long-term impact on oil? Now, right now, we're seeing that OPEC and non-OPEC are trying their best to keep prices elevated right around that $40 level or so. But when we're talking about down 42% for the year and a commodity that's a use asset, as opposed to a stock that has future earnings potential, we're talking about a use asset, which is really clearly all about supply and demand. And when the demand may not be there, is that something that we want to participate in? So we've been scratching our head, coming up with some other solutions for our clients because that positioning in the portfolio, we think that it's kind of ripe to change. And there's a couple different options right now that we're looking at. And I want you to look at your portfolio also and look where your energy exposure is and if, in fact, there is the proper diversification. Again, we've been very patient with our commodity exposure and doing okay with the underside of the precious metals, of course, and some ags here and there. But yet, when we lump it all together, the totality of the return has really been disappointing. So therefore, what we think, if we are headed towards inflationary period over time, whether it's today, tomorrow, next year, and if in fact the use asset, which is really based on supply demand, is going to have some problem with the demand component, then that's something we really need to rethink. So the energy component of that is something that I'm very concerned about, something we're looking at. We're going to make a smart, a thoughtful, and a very good decision. But the bottom line is that right now, it does seem like there's really not a lot of opportunity for long-term demand to continue. Now, long bonds last week were also down. We saw yields tick higher. And this is another area we discussed over the past couple of weeks. Back to this inflation discussion. Now, if you want to hear all about what we talked about with regard to inflation, how it's impacting, where the opportunity is, where it looks like it's going, listen to episode number 684 last week. There's plenty of information about the topic in there, the three things that we talked about on how to look at inflation and what to do. If, in fact, we do see that there is clear and present inflation going to start to infiltrate economies worldwide. Now, markets for the week, U.S. large caps were down for the week. Small caps were up. Emerging markets were up. When I looked at value and growth, we saw that value was up. Growth was down. The tech was down, ticking down. Otherwise, I think, you know, generally speaking, right now, we're in a really just a wait and see. We are just in, let's get through this week, the end of the month. Let's get through whatever we have out there. The presidential election is coming. Hopefully, we're going to get a resolution on this. Hopefully, in a timely basis. Quickly, get it done. We know who the next president is going to be, and we can move on from there with proper knowledge, no crazy delays and all that, which is possible. No contested election like they're talking about. Hopefully we can get a clear and definitive winner right off the bat. And of course we have the stimulus issue, which quite frankly is being jerked around by every side. You hear multiple variations throughout the day that flip and flop and come back and flop and flip again throughout the entire day. It's amazing what's going on with regard to the political. I think this is political. At least it seems it smells political. It looks like this whole thing being jerked around is all about, let's just figure out a way for making one side or the other look bad into the election and holding that. Now, it pisses me off, to be honest with you, because what that means is that these people that are doing the jerking are simply doing it for their own job. They're not looking out at the benefits of their constituents. They're not doing anything to help those that are in need. And I'm not going to go into this because we've done this before and talked about this a bit, but I just got to tell you, it's disgusting. It's foul. Next week, coming into the end of the month, we have some interesting economics, which I don't really, again, necessarily think there's going to be a lot that's going to move the needle right now into the election and whatever happens with the stimulus. But we do have GDP, gross domestic product, coming in for the third quarter. So that's going to be interesting to see because we're expecting to see a very substantial number, obviously a rebound off of that bottom where we saw a negative 30%+ last quarter. We should see a reasonable level, you know, in the 20 to 30% or even a little higher for this, as we saw that V economic bottoming happening and then the launch off the bottom as everything started to open up again and we got the economy back to work. So there's going to be some decent GDP numbers. But again, I would tell you that what I've seen right now from an economist, from looking at economists and looking at analysts for stocks, nobody really has any kind of real clue as to what's going on. Numbers are so far away from reality in the estimates. I would put those all aside and let's just see what the numbers come out to be. We're also going to see new home sales, which are probably going to come in pretty strong after we see such an incredible drop in overall inventories and demand being really high. A real bright spot in the economy. Personal income and spending, we're also going to have next week. Let's see, what else do we have? We have PCE prices towards the end of the week. This is an inflation gauge that the Fed looks at. And at the end of the week, we're also going to see on Friday, the University of Michigan consumer sentiment. But again, I don't think a lot of these are really going to have the ability, unless they're really, really off, the ability to really change general sentiment, which is this wait and see situation. I mean, even with the global COVID case count reaching a record, hospitalizations and positivity rates ticking up, there's the notion that there is this stimulus that will be coming, whether it's going to be 1.2, 1.5, 1.8, 2.2, whatever the number is here in the US. And on top of that, the fact that the Fed has everybody's backs, I don't think there's going to be a lot of panic going on until after we see what the results of the election are and what the results of the stimulus will be, of how much we're actually going to get. The stimulus, no matter what we get, is going to be enormous. $1 trillion is enormous. While it may be disappointing to the markets, it's large, huge, big. And in fact, while that may not help anything to do with the virus, it may cure a lot of financial ills for a little while. So that's something to keep in mind. Now, next week, a quick couple of housekeeping notes. Next week, we're scheduled to have a great guest. I've known this guy for years, and he's become a great friend over those years. And he is what we call the Podfather, Adam Curry, who is co-host of the No Agenda podcast. I'm looking forward to a really good episode. Adam has a wealth of knowledge on all sorts of areas. We're going to talk about his beginnings. Hopefully, I'm going to ask about and explain to his beginnings in the area of podcasting, as well as what's going on and how it all began. A couple other things, quick items. Do me a favor, follow me on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz is one word. Andrew Horowitz is my Twitter handle. Like The Disciplined Investor on Facebook, please. Do me a favor. We'll post all information about the podcast and all that there. Also, Monday is pop-up Q&A webinars. You ask the questions, I'm there to help you. You got to register over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com on the top right. So that looks like gives us all the information you need to know. Now, let's get into the focus of this week's topic. I think it's going to be really interesting. And our guest today is Chuck Trafton, and he is the president and co-founder of Edly. And he's responsible for Edly's origins, working with schools and student channels to create ISA contracts, which we're going to talk about. You know, I wanted to get Chuck on because we've talked about a variety of different investments and areas and things outside the box lately. That's been a topic we've really been focusing on. So, Chuck, thanks for joining us and going over this really interesting, well, this is just fascinating what you do. I appreciate it.
Thanks. I agree. I appreciate you having me on.
So let's talk a little bit about Edly. Let's kind of just start from the scratch, you know, the beginnings, the basics, and explain what Edly's all about.
Yeah, so Edly is the ISA marketplace. We are an alternative investment marketplace that connects the capital markets to a new asset class called income share agreements, or ISAs. And income share agreements are an increasingly popular alternative to private student loans. There's about $100 billion of new student loans created every year. Most of that is a government student loan program, and most students should take as much of that as possible. But $15 to $20 billion per year of private student loans are also created, and that's what ISAs compete with. It's a new form of tuition funding where investors pay a student's tuition in lieu of a private student loan, and in return receive a certain percentage of income for a certain number of years after the student graduates. And it's very unlike a loan in that there's a minimum income threshold. So the students only have to make payments when they're working and making above, say, 40K, although it can be as high as 60 or 80K, depending on the school and the major. And there's a maximum repayment cap, unlike a student loan, which you can pay back 9, 10, 15 times what you borrowed. The max repayment cap on Edly ISA is typically 1.5 or 2 times the tuition. So it's more like equity than debt. And many students and their families very much appreciate this option.
So that's exactly what it sounds like. I was just thinking of that as you were saying it. It's kind of like, on one hand, how am I going to capitalize my business? And then the question is, what's my business, right? My business is me, right? My future business is me. Whether you work for a company, you have your own firm that you start. But after I exit college, you know, how am I going to fund the startup? That's how I'm looking at this. Tell me if I'm wrong with this whole theory. But how am I going to fund the startup? And then I'm going to have some venture capitalists that are going to invest in me, or am I going to go out to the debt markets and borrow to try to fund the enterprise? Is that kind of a good way to look at it?
Yeah, that's the right frame of reference. I like to think about it as the one of the best investments you can make is an investment in yourself, and education is one of the best investments you can make in yourself. And to your point, the question is how to capitalize that. So right now, we only fund seniors in the undergrad schools. Mm-hmm. And so by the time you've got to your senior year of college, you probably already have a few years of debt already taken on. And so this is a welcome addition to be able to come back for your senior year, no debt, all equity, right? It's also a major carrot on a stick that we think will help increase the graduation rate in this country. And so we also do people getting graduate degrees, but they have to be within 18 months of receiving their master's or PhD. And by the time they're in that level, they're also already probably have a lot of student loans. I mean, you don't have to read very far in the newspaper to know that this is a $1.4 trillion market that most Americans are not pleased with.
So are you concerned, you know, the market, this $1.5 trillion market right now that has really, you know, again, getting back to the same model where you have too much debt outstanding, it provides for a detriment to the long-term growth of a company. And again, we're talking about the company being me here. If I have too much debt that I'm saddled with, it's very difficult to get from under that because you're always paying only a small part of the principal, some interest over time. And that's what happens with student debt. That's why we have so many people living with their parents, aside from all the COVID issue. What's happening now? Are you concerned about what if there is some kind of legislation that comes along and kind of pays off the student the debt out there? Is that even something that you're thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the higher education market is highly regulated, as is the consumer financial system in this country. And so we abide by all existing and regulations. And there's a lot of talk about free college or a debt jubilee. And I think that this kind of gets to the core of the what most Americans know, is that these are symptoms of a rotten system.
Mm-hmm.
Why would we even need to be talking about these radical changes? But the way things are going, it's almost like healthcare in this country. The healthcare costs are ballooning out of control as a percent of the pie. And unless something radical changes, we're really on a very difficult path. I think higher education finance is one of the biggest challenges our society has. And so there are a lot of proposals for radical change, because that's really what's required. We think that ISAs are part of that solution. Not every school in the country is even eligible to have an ISA program. You know, we track and rank all 7,000 schools in the U.S., community colleges, universities, vocational schools, boot camps, training programs, and we rank them top to bottom based on what we call ROE, the return on education. So what is the student getting in exchange for that tuition that they're forking over? What is the return on that investment? Because in many cases, this is a six-figure investment that you're asking young people to take on. And our analysis shows that about the top quartile of those 7,000 institutions have economics that would sustain an ISA program. Because the tuition is a value, even though tuition might be high at some of these schools, it's generally worth it if you graduate. And so it's an investment worth making. It's just that it's a very high ticket cost right now. And so these kids and their families need assistance in making this investment. ISAs are not for everyone, and they're not for every school. Like I said, more than half of the schools really either have overpriced tuitions or just very underwhelming outcomes relative to the tuition they're pricing. And so this is not a universal solution, but this is a way that we can use the capital markets to help better allocate the scarce resources we have in a $1 trillion economy known as education.
Right, exactly. So now, as we see this, I mean, obviously there are some that would really gravitate to doing this, those students that want to do this. And my question is that, you know, when we break this down now, so I say, yeah, I'm interested in doing this and I'm going to have a part or some of my tuition paid through this ISA. What happens once I get out of college, once I start working?
So what happens is, we at Adley hire servicers, ISA servicers that do income verification, payment collections, payment processing, and we can see when the students are getting jobs. We know how much money they're making or they're not making, and if they're making above that minimum income threshold, they're expected to make monthly payments to us based on the income share percentage of their agreement. And typically, you know, you're going to get a few months of grace period after you get out of school, mm-hmm. give you enough time to find a job.
Right.
But again, if you get out of school and you're not working, you're not required to make payments. Whereas with a student loan, you got to make payments every month, whether you're working or not, no matter how much money you're making. Maybe you have to take a year off to take care of your sick parents. You know, student loans don't care about the fact that life happens. And with the ISA, it's designed to be more flexible and by definition affordable, since we're only taking a low percentage of income when you're working and making above a certain base rate.
So now it's
a lot of insurance for the students.
So, and it's a lot less sweat. I mean, it's not that they don't want to get a job. It's just, you know, you're looking for, you know, getting them the right position and getting them a decent job and then starting to collect, you know, to collect what's due back on the ISA. So when you have these students and you have these pool, it's not just one-offs, right? So you have these pool of students. Who are the investors? Who's putting the money in? How does that work?
So we have almost 1,500 investors in the platform now. These are insurance companies, impact investors, family offices, institutional credit funds, accredited high net worth individuals. And there's a lot of investors that want access to this asset class. And there are many, many schools that are starting ISA programs. And so we created Edly as the marketplace where the two could meet up. Mm-hmm. And the investors on our platform, again, they go from the largest institutions in the country to, you know, individuals who put $10,000 or $20,000 into a pool. You're not investing in an individual.
Right.
Student.
It's not like you're picking John Smith, right?
Right.
So it's
you're investing in a broad-based pool that might have 1,000 students in it from, you know, computer science, nursing, vocational schools. We create a diversified pool for these investments. And so you own your pro rata share to the payments that come in. The investors like this because A, it's got an attractive yield. You know, we target 12 to 13% net IRR after fees and defaults and everything. And our early results have been slightly better than that. And also it's a major impact investment because every dollar of ISA is another student loan that's off the street, and that's considered a social good. It also is relatively uncorrelated to the other alternative asset classes. So, you know, this is a unique asset that's tied to wages. And in that sense, it can provide inflation participation. In addition to being pro-cyclical, you know, you get the benefit of wage inflation. Usually investors have to pay a premium in the portfolio to protect against inflation. Here, you actually can participate in it with because you're receiving a set percentage of wages. So the investors all like it for a variety of reasons. There's also potentially very attractive tax advantages of ISA investing. And, you know, that's why our marketplace is increasingly popular with investors of many stripes.
So you have this pool, you have the monthly returns that happen. So if I'm an investor and I go in and I, you know, put in $10,000, what is my expectation? Is it like the pool's open for a period of time until it closes? And then that pool is set, or is the pool continually rotate throughout the lifespan of the investment?
You can choose to reinvest the cash flows into the pool, but generally we send out cash flows every month to each investor on the 25th of the month. Because every pool that we create has some students that have already graduated and are working and are making payments, some students that have just graduated school, and some that are about to graduate. And so the pools that investors are coming into are already cash flowing a little bit. So we start paying out monthly cash flows every month, and they can either reinvest them or take them as distributions. One of the interesting factors about ISA investing is that we believe the ISA or the IRS treats these as open transactions. And what an open transaction means is that, you know, because your money is at risk, let's say none of the students ever pay, if you make a $10,000 investment, the first $10,000 that you receive in distributions come in tax-free. And then after that, everything after your initial investment is considered ordinary income. So your first up to your investment amount comes in tax-free, as opposed to, let's say you made a student loan. You lent somebody $10,000. Mm-hmm. As soon as they graduate and start making payments to you, those principal and interest payments they're making to you are taxable. Whereas with that first $10,000 you receive back in an ISA investment is considered a return of capital, and so it's not taxed.
So that's FIFO. That's a FIFO first in, first out, which is kind of interesting where most things are not.
Yeah.
Most things are LIFO, right? So most things are whatever you make is what you're taxed on first, and then eventually when you get down to your principal. Now, are these available? I just thought of this out of nowhere, but are these available in IRAs?
Yes.
Wow, you could do it in IRAs too. Wow, that's interesting. Huh. So
right. So now you're getting a very attractive yield and an uncorrelated asset that's a unique new asset class with major social impact investment. And of course, we're not tax advisors, and everybody should consult their own tax.
Yep. Good point.
Advisor.
Good point.
Yep. But we believe that the tax advantages to this are pretty attractive.
So how are investors protected? So, you know, what happens if, I don't know, some crazy situation happens, you know, where you have, well, I don't know, like a pandemic. and all of a sudden a lot of people are out of work. But how are people generally protected long-term with this?
Well, that starts with our underwriting. As I mentioned, we track and rank all of the schools in the country on various public and privately available information. So, you know, what happens to a nursing major from NYU? You know, what is his or her first few years out of school look like typically? And we model that out and we stress test it and we assume recessions and what if wage inflation isn't what it used to be? What if it takes longer for people to find jobs? We have very sophisticated modeling tools also that our institutional clients use to do what if scenarios. So it really starts with our underwriting. That's why we only go after the top programs, the top schools. And by that, I don't mean necessarily, you know, the Ivy Leagues and the top U.S. News World Report ranked schools. I mean the top schools where the ROE, the return on education, is very high. So what are you getting for income when you graduate versus what you paid for tuition? That's really the essence of the ISA. And so it starts with underwriting. Second is, we have contract law that goes back 300 years in this country. These are valid contracts that are signed either between the school and the student or between Edley and the student. And it can be beneficial to their credit score, for example, when they get out to make the payments because you get credit for making payments while there's no associated debt. And we hire servicers that effectively and economically service these assets. We do income verification through services like Equifax and Plaid and ADP. And we also get the students' tax returns. So we know, you know, how much they're reporting to the government that they're making, and we sync that up with what they told us and what we know them to
make
be
sure
making.
It's right on, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So these, you know, we're very cognizant of this because, especially early on when this is a new asset class, these need to be good performing investments if ISAs are going to become anything other than a niche. They have huge potential. We think it could be $4 or $5 billion a year. But today it's a very small market, about $300 million per year, but it's doubling every year. And as long as these prove to be good investments, and we strongly believe that when education is done right, it's a terrific investment. Once these build up a further track record, I think you'll see an explosion of its use across the country and go mainstream.
Interesting. So let's go back a little bit. You mentioned that the contract could be done between either the student and Edley or the student and the college. If it does go through the college, is the college part of the benefactor of any of the future ISA?
Yeah, so we originate contracts one of two ways. We either sign a contract with a school who then rolls it out through their financial aid office to all the students, or we contract directly with the students through various channels. We can advertise and sign contracts with students at certain schools that we're targeting. In the first case, when we're contracting with a school, yes, part of the benefit of that is the school will also jointly invest in the program.
Oh.
And this has several fold effects. So number one, the school can say to the student, look, we're making an investment in you. If it doesn't work out for you, it doesn't work out for us. And it's a very powerful message the schools can tell the students, and very unlike, you know, anything they could ever, a discussion they could ever have when they're talking about student loans. And second is the investors like that because we can tie, you know, you want to incentivize the schools to have the students' outcomes be as positive as possible. And so in many cases, the investors are not just buying the ISAs from the school, they're jointly investing in the ISAs with the school. And the school will offer certain negotiable guarantees, for example. Sometimes they'll buy back the ISA from the investors if the student doesn't graduate. Or maybe they'll buy back the ISA if the student doesn't get a job within 6 months or things like this. This is all negotiable. And so we like it when we contract with the schools because then we don't have to go get the students ourselves. The school rolls it out through the financial aid office, but also because we can tie the school into the investment as well. And this is a game changer relative to the for-profit education industry the last 30 years. Which, as you probably remember, back in the 90s and early 2000s, really became a mess because these for-profit universities, many of which were public companies, you know, had no incentive to actually graduate the students and get them good jobs. The only incentive they have was to enroll more students. And right. So you have
right.
these terrible cases yeah. where...
And they were all shut down, you know, eventually, some of the, right?
Some of these universities were literally taking homeless people
yeah.
from the shelter, signing them up for classes they knew they would never attend. They got the student loan, paid the school, and they would send the people right out the back door. That's really awful. And that's why the for-profit education industry still has a challenging reputation today, because it's for very good reasons. This solves part of that issue, where if we can get the school to actually be invested mm-hmm. in the student's outcome,
right.
literally and financially, they have a whole new bag of incentives, which is to graduate them on time and get them good jobs.
Right.
And so we think that this is like a total difference than the way that the education investment market has worked in this country for years.
Well, right now, the only incentive really that a school has is to keep you on the curriculum through the end of your graduation, somehow to get each and every credit hour paid for, right? That's kind of where they are right now. And they don't really care where they get the money from. So what this is doing is actually tying, because once they graduate, it's all over, right? Who cares? It's all done for the school. They can't, unless they sign you up for graduate courses and, you know, beyond that. But what you're telling me this now makes a greater amount of benefit for all parties involved, because there is a additional tag on this. And that beyond school, first you want to get them through school, but then you want to give them the highest education theoretically so that they can get the best job theoretically, so they can pay back this deal in the future in a complete fashion. So everybody's kind of working for the same goal.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Huh. I believe strongly in the power of alignment of interest.
Yeah, that's exactly.
And anywhere in this economy where we can get everybody rowing in the same direction, in this case, schools, students, their families, and investors, then everybody's on the same page about what exactly we're expecting to get here from an outcome. And it's a way of holding schools accountable. Let's be honest. With education inflation in this country has been crippling the middle class mm-hmm. and the lower income families sure. for decades now. And this is a way the schools say to step up and say, yeah, our tuition might be high, but it's worth it.
Right.
And we'll put our money where our mouth is.
Right. So now there's two early items that I want to talk about. So the first early item would be, what if, let's say, that a student graduates and they start working and they're making okay money. I don't know what happens. Let's say they get a great inheritance. Can they buy their contract out early and pay? Is there some kind of a valuation that you put on what's owed?
They can. They can, although typically there's not much of an incentive for them to do that, because then they would have to pay off the repayment cap. So let's say we paid $10,000 for tuition, you get a good job, the max will pay us back is 1.5 times that, you know, $15,000. If you want to prepay it, you typically have to pay back the max repayment cap of mm-hmm. 1.5 times.
Right.
We also have schools, though, that have a graduated repayment cap. So if you pay it off after 1 year, you only have to pay 1.2 times. If you pay it off after 3 years, 1.3 times, things like that. So mm-hmm. we do build in graduated repayment schedules. But in general, it's always advantageous for the student to keep this, because what if you lose your job tomorrow?
Right.
You know,
right.
Then, you know, you're not going to have to make the ISA payments. You go into deferment. And yet we get a handful of students every month that actually pay us off in full. And I think the reason why is a lot of them work in tech and they get signing bonuses.
Right.
Just, and
they
so
want to clean it all up.
You right. work as a new programmer or right. data scientist and they give you 20 or 30 grand. So you can pay off your ISA in one fell swoop, and that just increases your cash flow in the future. But there really isn't an incentive to do that. So it's always an interesting behavior to observe, but it happens quite a bit.
Listen, it's like people that don't want to have mortgages on their house, right? And the interest rate's 1%. And they're like, I just don't want a mortgage.
Right.
Like, but why not have a mortgage if it's at 1%? Or if that is available. Or I just don't like a mortgage. You know, they just don't like any debt right. hanging over. They were taught early on.
Or they have something better to do with the money, right? Maybe
right.
there's something else they want to buy.
Yep.
But I think a lot of people, especially young people, it feels better to get a higher monthly cash flow and to have lower bills at the end of the month. But yeah, that's an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, we're all trained to pay monthly now. You know, it used to be that you bought a product and you paid for it. Now everybody's on some kind of Apple or Adobe or cable or phone monthly payment plan.
Brazil is very far along with that. In Brazil, some parts of Latin America, when you go to the store, you don't see the price tag of an item. You see the monthly payment for that item.
Yeah. I'm not sure.
It's only 20 cents instead of $15. Oh, okay. I'll buy it.
I'll buy that. Yeah. So what about if an investor wants to pull out early? That was my second item on the early topic. What if I'm an investor and I invested $25,000 and I say, I don't know, can I cash out of all a part of it earlier than the length of the term of the fund, you know, going through full completion?
Yeah. So Edley is currently not an exchange. We're not a broker dealer. So there's not a secondary market yet in that fashion where you could buy them 1 month and sell them, you know, 6 months later. It's really just a primary issuance market. So most of the investors are buying these with the idea of we're going to hold it to maturity, which is about 4.5 years. Four and a half years is the average maturity. Most of these will be paid off within 4 years.
Okay.
But if you do want to sell and get some liquidity, or you have to sell, we can make a best efforts job to place that or potentially even invest in ourselves. But we don't guarantee any liquidity. These are really like buy and hold, alternative credit instruments.
And then what about transferability? Is if I buy this and I don't know, my brother Bob wants to pick this up from me because I need out, can I transfer it at least? I guess you could transfer ownership of anything, can't you?
I think you could transfer ownership of it. Yeah, I would have to look in the purchase agreement whether it's transferable or not, but I don't think that. I'd have to look at the documentation.
Yeah, good stuff. So, Edley, this is an interesting new asset class. I guess we'll call it a new opportunity for income, something cool. That's, again, I wanted to bring you on, Chuck, because there are so many people that are just like focused in on stocks or focused in on, you know, Bitcoin or focused in on just gold. And my goal through this whole process of what's going on right now with the volatility, what's happened since the March lows, the unknowns that could be out there is kind of just try to bring a little bit more information about what else is out there in the world. And this is definitely one of those things that I think is going to, you know, bring a lot more attention, especially because of all the problems we have in the educational system. So hopefully this is going to work out well for you. And I appreciate you coming on board.
Yeah, thanks. Students and their families really appreciate it. The schools really appreciate the value proposition and the signaling of an ISA program. And the investors definitely appreciate the investment opportunity, especially when you consider the triple bottom line opportunity with the social impact.
Yep.
Thanks for helping me spread the word.
Yeah, we're going to have all the information on the show notes for this episode, number 685, over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can find out more information at www.edley, which is EDLY.CO, and edleystudent.com. So we'll have all that information as well as your bio and the things where you can grab more information over on our website as well. So listen, you be well. I hope to have you back. Appreciate it.
Thanks. We'll talk again soon.
That's going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me. Hopefully check out all there is to understand and know and find out about with Edley. I think it's a really cool platform overall. Again, you can go over to edley.co, EDLY.co, or edleystudent.com. Two places to check out everything that we talked about and more with our guest Chuck today. So be there next week again when we talk with Adam Curry. Make sure to be there for DH Unplugged on Tuesday night. And until then, have a great week. Have a profitable week. I'll see you around the corner. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.